Welcome to episode 73 of the Digital Fabrication Experiment, hosted by Eddie, Chris, and myself, Winston. We're a couple of CNC nerds, and these are our conversations about life in the shop, things we're making, and what we're learning along the way. Eddie, Chris, it's been a very long time. How are you guys doing?
Very good, guys. Good to be back together.
Yeah, it's been almost a year, I think, or something, right? That we've talked.
Last episode was April of 22 with Marvin Grobe.
That's crazy. I think a lot of it's been a long time, so there's been a lot of stuff that's been going on. I guess I can just jump right into it. I guess for me, the last time we talked, I had talked about that I was working at Amazon for Project Kuiper, and then since then, I have left Amazon and I now work for Hadrian. I guess I could talk about why I left. Generally, you know, Amazon, it was an amazing place. The people are great. The project was amazing. I mean, I got to work on a Kern HD. And a Hermley and stuff every day. So that was nothing short of dream come true for me, right? So why did I leave then? That's usually the question people want to know. When I look at like manufacturing as a whole on the macro view in the United States, I think about where do I see myself in like 5, 10, 15, 20 years or whatever. And when I look at the state of manufacturing in the US, I think there's going to be a problem that I think everybody in the industry knows, but I didn't see anybody doing anything about it. And that problem is, one, we do not have enough people coming into our industry to refill the people that are about to retire. We have a lot of experienced, talented manufacturing, like in above just machining guys or operative. We have a lot of talented manufacturing guys in the US, but we don't have a way to take all that tribal knowledge out of their brain and train the next like generation of people. Our main like industrial like revolution from the war hasn't really changed as far as like infrastructure or the way that we do things, right? And I'm sure everybody who's listening here that's ever had to deal with the vendor make a part knows the struggle of getting something like to your shop on time. And it could be something as dumb as you sent an email to the vendor to make a part, and you got quoted and everything went through, and then that guy forgot to send an email for his stock. So now the stock's delayed a week, and that pushes everything out like, you know, 7 to 14 days later. This is just how we do business. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to fly in the next like 5 to 10 years as like technology advances. I don't feel like we are going to be able to keep up, not only on a global scale, but we are currently in the midst of like the next big space race, and we can thank SpaceX for that, right? The fact that they're able to make launches more affordable, and they're doing tons of launches every year. So now you have companies that are brand new startups that are doing incredible things related to the space race. And when I look at like, are we going to win this? Like in a sense of like, are we going to be able to keep up with the demand of like things that these companies need us to build, whether it's satellite parts or rocket parts or whatever it is that you're making. The answer initially was, I don't think so. It doesn't feel like that. I mean, we have a lot of these mom and pop shops, family-owned businesses supporting huge space companies, making parts in their garage and stuff. And like, all it would take is like for a few of these shops to go under or no longer be serviced to cause a ripple effect in like the ability for us to get parts. I don't know the exact data, but I do know from reading multiple sources and articles that like our current like Air Force like fighter jets and stuff, a majority of them are grounded because they don't have a complete set of parts to make them go. And part of that is like the way that our entire manufacturing infrastructure is set. So that's a long way of saying like, I feel like there's a problem coming. I saw that problem. I wanted to figure out like, how can I be a part of that solution? And that's when I discovered Hadrian, because they are exploring the idea of like, how do we fix this? And they understand the urgency that you cannot wait until the problem truly arrives. You need to start years in advance, because we basically need to build everything from the ground up again. We need to redesign how we think manufacturing should be done, and we need to do it from the base to the top, meaning like software needs to be integrated like with the way that we do manufacturing. That has never been, at least to my eyes, I've never seen anybody do. I'm talking like full-on ERP integration, like everybody's dream of how we want to do things, right? Where a customer sends a quote, the quote gets brought in, the quote is then scanned by AI and automatically ballooned and then generated. It looks for things that might be issues for DFM, sends a reply back, and then that thing gets auto-quoted based on a data set of like parts that were similar that were made previously. And that thing enters the queue, it gets sent off to the programmer and also the CMM inspector. They have a task that pops up in their window or the ERP system. And then that tells them, okay, you need to start working on this, release the stock. That pings the guy over by the bandsaw to cut the stock. And then while this is happening, there's a scheduler that's figuring out where to fit this job into the arsenal of machines that we have. And then while that's going on, once the programming inspection stuff is closed, then that pings the operator. The stock is now sitting by the machine. You can run the prove out. They're able to run the part, and then this is all being like data recorded, right? So we know if we're going to be late ahead of time, or we know if we're going to be early. And while all this is happening, the customer at any point in time can log into their what I call like the Domino's Pizza login. You know, like when you order Domino's Pizza, it tells you, hey, your pizza is being made, your pizza is being delivered, or like yeah, in the oven. Yeah. So we have the same thing where you can see your part on the machine and where it's at currently. And you'll know, you don't need to call, you don't need email, you can just check at any time of the day if we're going to be late or not. So this is going to force us to be incredibly good with our processes because we can't lie, but also just be completely transparent, which is something I think that most people want in this industry that we've never been able to do before. So then the part gets made, then the OS, the outside processing department, gets pinged for them to send things out. If it needs to be chem film anodized, whatever, engraving, come back, inspection reports, packed, shipped, all that stuff. So that's like the whole thing. So how do you build all this? You have to hire a bunch of software guys and you sit them next to a bunch of CAM programmers and machinists, and all we do all day is argue about how to make our product better. And when I say product, I mean the factory. Because ultimately, it's not what we're making that's important, it's how we're making it, and the factory is our product, right? So all these things that we're building custom ERP, we're building all this like automation. And when I say automation, it's like multi-leveled. I mean, just think, we're automating not only programming, where I don't have to pick a vice, I don't have to pick stock size, I don't need to do general like 3D toolpaths or 3-axis toolpaths. All that stuff is just basically a click of a button for me. It runs a script, analyzes things, and then it basically pops out a bunch of toolpaths. I only do like the hard stuff that my human brain needs to do, which is like 5-axis things or complex like surfaces or things like that.
I'm assuming like every time you do that, the system's learning like where you had to intervene and ideally like remembering, so next time it can do that without skilled intervention potentially, right?
Everything that I do is being collected as data, and we're not doing it to like find where people suck. Well, kind of we are, but we're trying to find where people suck so that we can help them be better, right? So all these things that are happening, we're also recording like what type of feature sets were in this part, and then what did we classify them as? And then we'll also look at things like, hey, we've made that part similar to that before. We've made it this way, and this way was more successful than other ways. So we should probably try to use this way to make this part again. And that helps us with coding and speed and things like that, right? But this is an ever evolving like data collection thing of, we're constantly being able to like improve ourselves because we know exactly what we did that was not effective, and we know what is effective, right? So it's like a, to me, it's mind blowing. I love it because like for me, it's always been about how do I get really good at my job, and like this place is like beyond anything I can ever comprehend as well as like that. So automation for programming, right? We have automation for inspection. I mean, if you go to our LinkedIn, like our CEO posted pictures, we have like our KUKA robots and stuff, or UR10 robots sitting there like automating inspection at night. So the robot moves pallets to the CMM, and then the CMM runs the inspection at night. And if it passes, it goes here. If it fails, it goes there. And then like we can continually run inspection even when we're not there. And like this thing of automation trickles down to like every facet of the company, whether you're doing quoting, how do we automate that? When you're doing scheduling, how do we automate that? And the idea is never try to like, you can never fully automate 100%, but man, if you just do like 50, 60% and you just start removing the clicks that a human has to do, you'd be surprised at how much efficiency that you can gain over time. And as we work toward like being fully autonomous, quote unquote, like even if we get 80% of the way, I mean, that's incredible. Like if you think about your entire workflow for like making a part, if I were able to automate 80% of that, how easy would your life be? Right. So that's like the really broad strokes, like overview of like what Hadrian is, why I left, why I think it's our, why I'm concerned about like our manufacturing power in the US. And I truly believe that like Hadrian is going to be, if we're successful, because, you know, there is no such thing as a sure bet. But if we are successful, I think we will put, bring back some of the prowess that we had from a while back. So, and when I look at the 5, 10, 15 year plan, as much as Amazon excited me, the people were great, the machines were great, I felt like this was more about my calling of why I swapped to manufacturing in the first place. Like, why did I leave nursing to begin with, right? And it was because I wanted to do something incredibly meaningful with my life. And it's difficult to top meaningful when you're working with people's lives, right? And like dealing with cancer and things like that. But this has definitely made that, has brought some of that meaning back. And I feel like this is truly fulfilled like my itch for why I left in the first place, why I wanted to be here, why I love doing what I'm doing so much. And, you know, I've only been there for about like a month now, right? A little bit over a month. I have learned so much in this month. It's incredible. And the reason why is because I have a team of like 10 programmers that are some of the best programmers that I've ever talked to. And all day we're just looking at each other, asking questions, learning off of each other, sharing information. You know, I don't have to like beg the old guy in the corner, hey, how did you do that? And he doesn't want to share it because, you know, he's afraid of like job security and stuff. None of that exists. There is no ego. Everybody just shares what they can, because ultimately if you can make everybody better, then your job gets easier, right? Because we're all there to be able to do what we need to do. So I love the energy that we have at the company. And I love that the mindset that that we have going into it, and the way that we're approaching things is just, in my opinion, smart and the best way to do things. So
the big challenge, at least from what I keep hearing from other podcasts, right, people are much more plugged into manufacturing than I am, is you know, the skills erosion in the US, right? You have a generation of very skilled talent that's reaching retirement age or probably even past it, and not necessarily a good pipeline for continuation of those skills into the next generation, because of, you know, manufacturing doesn't have the glamour that it used to have as far as perception. I actually think it's actually a fantastic place to plant your career in general, but you know, it's taking a while for the education system and society to kind of realize that, you know, you can have a very successful career in manufacturing. With or without a degree, right? There's plenty of spaces for pretty much anyone that's willing to work hard and learn. But in the, you know, how do we transition from very talented older generation that has unique skills, right? Probably the only ones that know how to make some of these aerospace parts you're talking about. How do you basically make sure we can continue to do that in the U.S., right? And it's either, and probably with a much smaller skill base would be my guess. So you either have to build software that can take, you know, basically leverage a highly skilled employee, basically be a force multiplier, help him do a lot more, you know what I'm saying, across more work.
Yeah.
By capturing some of that expertise in software. Because they, you know, they tend to be the bottleneck, right?
Yes. And the way that we're doing that, and I've seen this with my own eyes. I mean, like when I look out the floor and I see people running like the Hermes, we got our security guard is running parts for us and doing manual inspections. And like they basically taught him in like less than 2 months how to do all that stuff. We have people that we've hired from like Chick-fil-A. We've had like people that we've hired from energy, or they've from different, completely different fields, like pharmacy tech, like everywhere, welders, like, and it doesn't matter who you are, because the system that we're trying to build basically walks you through how to do whatever it is that we need you to do. And it does so in a way that has been backed by like many, many iterations of like process improvement. Right. So like when the operator's at the machine and they need to load or basically get the job ready, our ERP system, there's a computer next to it, and it's basically telling them, okay, this is op one, this is the first step. Here's a picture and the model numbers of all the work holding things you need to set up. Here's the orientation that you need to set them up in. Make sure that this is that. The CAM programmers can have notes in there for things that they want to like include, like, hey, be careful of this and that. Our standard operating procedures for like how to clamp vices and stuff has been tailored through like many iterations of like how to clamp things, how to clean things, like a lot of things that three of us probably don't think about because we're so accustomed to, but things like making sure like the jaws don't lift, there's no chips in there. Like you don't, you know, when you're clamping, make sure that you're like holding, like it sounds stupid, but it's stuff that we've learned. How did we learn? Because we've made mistakes. So then how do we prevent this new guy from making mistakes? By clearly documenting and also like having pictures and things and showing them how to do that. And it basically just guides them through this process of like how to set it up, how to run the part, what things are need to happen while it do that. We have in-process inspection things where we can tell the operator like, hey, every third part or fifth part, hey, check this. This is a critical dimension. This is how you check it. Click this. Here's a video of how you do that. Use a bore mic, use a gauge pin, whatever. So we have all these things kind of built into that. And it doesn't take a lot. Like after some really quick initial training of like teaching somebody how to do some basic things, we can then use that to like catapult launch them into, you know, actually running a machine and running a part. And I mean, yeah, it's crazy. And I've seen it work and it's amazing. And on top of that, seeing it work and then also like improving it. So like we're noticing that like newer people are coming in and they're learning quicker than the previous people. And it makes sense, right? Because like the first guy, he had to struggle through a lot of things. We had to figure out how to do things and stuff like that. But as we continuously improve, I can see that it's getting easier and better for the next person to like come in and get and ramped up to start working and stuff. So yeah, that's been a really, really, really fun to watch people from all walks of life coming into our industry and having fun and being successful at it.
Are you still in Los Angeles area, or did you have to move?
Yeah, I'm still in it. It's actually the same drive for me. So like Amazon was like, you know, Northridge. This is in Torrance. So for where I live, it's about the same Z's. It's not that bad. About the same time.
So Winston, how are things? You're still at Carbide 3D?
Yeah, but hold on. I want to circle back because, like, Chris, your encapsulation of Hadrian just led my brain in so many directions because it sounds so cool. Like, part of it, like, I think Tesla, because you guys, your process is the product. And then, like, I was, like, your DFM analysis, it was, like, it gave me Xometry vibes, right? Because they look at a part, they figure out which shop it's a best fit for. Except with you guys, you actually... like after that point, you don't lose that data. You actually you care about how the part is made and learning from that instead of just sending it to a shop and it goes into a void and you lose that knowledge. I guess the first question, just based on proximity and timeline, is have you guys noticed any retention issues from like the people you're hiring to run the machines? Does like automating so much of it kind of take the life out of it? Do they feel like an Amazon like package packer or something?
Good question. No. And the reason why is because even though we've automated a lot of stuff and we made things easy, the idea is to take all the monotonous things out of the person's life or job, right? So they could focus on the more interesting problems that a human should be focusing on. Right, like if you're sitting there and you're trying to do something and it's all you're doing is clicking buttons and making choices that are pretty standard, then why don't we just have a script that do all that for you so that when you get to the job, all you're doing is the hard stuff. And the company is like pushes really hard for everybody to like, hey, if something interests you and it's in line with like what we can do to make the factory better, do it. So like you have people that are operators that are doing a bunch of other stuff, right? Like you're not pigeonholed to that one thing. You're encouraged to like explore, look at other departments, see if there's anything that interests you. And there's always something that needs to be solved, right? Because there's so many problems that we need to fix or improve on. So even though you're doing something kind of easy, we still require that person to help in a sense where like they can help improve that process, right? There's always something to make better. So no matter what position or what thing that you're doing, honestly, if it gets boring, then we've succeeded, right? That's ultimately how I see it, is like if it is truly boring for us to like just make parts every week and like there's nothing new, we've literally succeeded our job. Because then that means anybody can come in and do it, right? But yeah, I mean, I'm doing like Python scripting stuff. I'm using like ChatGPT. I'm doing all these like side projects for automation that have nothing to do with like hand programming, but it would definitely help the company in the long runs, right? And everybody has like some project attached to them that they work on when they're not doing their main job. So as far as like breaking the monotony for that, that's usually what I see. And everyone seems pretty happy about it. Like, everyone's just super enthusiastic. And that's also new for me, too, right? Because usually it's just a bunch of grumpy old men and stuff like that. So, yeah, from what I've seen, the answer would be tentatively no. But that's ultimately what we strive for, is we want this to be boring. And, like, because that way we did it. Like, we succeeded.
Yeah, you've unlocked the master recipe.
So, you mentioned automation. Are you getting an opportunity to do any kind of programming for robotics, like any kinematic automation?
Yeah, if I wanted to, absolutely. My focus right now, I personally chose to do some automation projects that are more related to the menu, like programming and stuff, because that's what I'm interested in. But I have coworkers that are doing automation and like Python scripting. One of them is working on like the robot for the automation inspection. The project can be anything in the company. It doesn't have to be CAM programming, right? If you're a CAM programmer, it's whatever you want to do that you think will help. That's usually what we'll push to do, right? There's no limit, or no one's going to say you can't do that. It's something that you're really into. I think what they've realized is like when you let people do the things they really want to do, you get way better results.
Sounds like a very challenging job right up your alley, though.
The one thing I've always said is like, you know, when you spend a decade in a career that you're no longer in, for me, it's always been catch up, right? I am now not necessarily competing, but I am now in a pool of people that have been doing this for decades. And I've only been doing it for like 3-ish years. So for me, it's always been, how do I get to their level as fast as I can? The best way to do that is to sit next to them every day and learn from them, right?
Any current machines there?
No current machines. I think the work envelope is too restricting. We have 11 Hermley C42s.
That's not a bad compromise.
I freaking love the Hermleys, man. Like they deserve more credit and attention for the way they build their machines. I'm so impressed. They're just workhorse and they're consistent. I love them. And then we have 3 Grobes, I think 550s, big machines for right now. And then we just bought 2 3-axis Doosan machines to test out some flat plate stuff. There is a really big it's really hard to buy machines right now. I don't know if anyone's out there trying to buy one, but like a lot of the lead times for these manufacturers are very, very long. So it's hard to get stuff, but Doosan seems to be like they got a bunch of these sitting around. So we bought 2 of them just to test things out, test the process. Part of our automation is to like, our goal is to like in the future, how do we make it so that we can hire anybody that programs or works on any type of machine, meaning like if it's a Siemens, a Heidenheim, or a Fennec, how do we take these guys, bring them into our system, and it doesn't matter what you program or use or know how to use, but then it'll basically like add like a post-processor to that and make it work in our system. Right. So like, let's say you only knew how to do Fusion and Fennec. We would basically take the barriers away so that you could still use your Fusion and work or whatever. And it would still feed through our system and work on the Heidenheim, if that makes sense. Right. Ultimately, the goal is like to get to that point where it doesn't matter what you know, doesn't matter what you use. ultimately those things can be translated to the things that we use, right? So,
Chris, so you seem to be in a position to know kind of like how automation can pair with like human intellect. Hot take, how long do you think until we have ChatGPT for Cam?
That's hard, man. Like, I don't know if you have tried. I've actually tried. I've asked ChatGPT to write me programs and like different systems. So like Heidenhain, Fanuc and stuff. It can do it. You know, things like, hey, can you write me G code for an enamel of this diameter to cut a 1-inch square? And it'll do it, but it's not going to do any of the things that you want. It's not going to have a safety retract, or you know, it's going to plunge right into the stock. So then you have to start telling it, okay, can you add a safe plunge and retract? Can you add coolant? Can you add this? And it knows. And like a lot of times, because like I'm still learning the Heidenhain like post like code, I will ask it, hey, what is the G10 equivalent from Fanuc and Heidenhain? And it'll tell me, oh, it is blah 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 blah. I use it as a cheat sheet. Now, as far as like full on programming, I don't know. It's hard to say. I think it has what it needs, but it just needs a way to learn like the way that we would want it to be used. And I think that takes some kind of human level intervention or some way of like learning that may not be available to the language models that it is using right now, right? Because I don't know what it's doing right now. Is it just searching the internet and reading books? If that's the case, can anyone program just by searching? Maybe, and it depends how it eats that information, right? If it's watching a bunch of YouTube videos and like it can take down the script of how somebody ran a part and take that, sure. I've started using ChatGPT 4. I think it released recently. The computational stuff is a lot better. The answers are a lot more concise, but I can still catch it in mistakes because it does not have a way to discern between, like, in my opinion, like what is real information or good information or factual information and maybe in less factual or less good, so to speak.
Yeah, you better have full machine simulation.
yeah. And exactly. So I think it's going to be some time, ultimately only because that's not their focus. Like if OpenAI said tomorrow, all right, we're going to focus on getting ChatGPT to programs for us, I'm sure they can knock this out in like months, right? Or like a year. But because their overall focus is like overall human knowledge, like it's, I don't know when that's going to be, who knows when it'll be able to do it. But if you really wanted to do it, I feel like you could do it now because ultimately G-code's not changing. It's not like every year it's evolving. It's like the same thing that we've been using for years, right? So it has what it needs.
There's potential there. Right? You could take that same AI model and focus on like a domain specific training. You know, if that's what you wanted was a ChatGPT programming expert, you could probably create one, you know, with the right training on the model, the right data set, it would probably become very good at it.
Yeah. And if you were feeding, like if you could pull ChatGPT offline onto like a local server and you can train it and you could tell it like, hey, check out this post. This is what I want. Like as far as output for a program, I just want you to change these things or, hey, I need a pro. Yeah. The problem you're going to have though is you can tell it to do something verbally, but it needs to be able to like, you're not going to be able to describe an entire part feature by feature, right? You're going to have to give it a print. You're going to have to give it a model. So then you're going to need to train ChatGPT to read that print and model, right? So you'll need these tools to do that. And ironically enough, we have those tools in-house that we've developed, right? And that's part of the way that we can do like automated quoting and things like that. So yeah, as far as like how, when ChatGPT would do it, who knows? It just depends how focused someone is at trying to get it to work. And then you'll need those tools in order to get it to like, you know, read those features and things like that to actually know how to do that. So
what I'm hearing is it's possible. We just need someone to focus on training on like machining data and tool paths and seeing how people like actually program, and we'll be there in like a year.
Come on, we can strap 37 rockets and send it to space. We can probably get this to work. It, like I said, ChatGPT is, it's amazing. It's not perfect. I've caught it in, I call it lying to me, like lies, but it's not lying. It's just, it's doing its best in like giving me the information that I've requested, but I've caught it in like things like formulas that are incorrect, or when I ask it to solve things computationally for me, it'll give me one answer the first time, and then it'll give me a different answer the second time, and it'll be like, oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I thought you meant this, and it's like, well, why didn't you just ask me to clarify? You know, there's stuff like that, but it'll be very scary though when it gets perfect or near perfect. It'll be pretty terrifying. Can you imagine a world where you're like not even Googling anymore, you're just like talking to someone and that person is ChatGPT and they're having conversation with you and ordering your dinner and like doing monotonous things and emails and whatever, taking care of your travel plans and things like that. It's amazing yet scary.
I think the scariest part is just if people become reliant on this, like what you were saying, ChatGPT gives you answers, but what it doesn't show you is its confidence level, right? So it's trying to deliver facts and knowledge, and if it's got to kind of read between the lines in a certain place, it'll just give you a statement, and if you dig a little deeper and you find out it's not true, well then you've just unraveled everything. But what happens when that becomes even broader? I just helped one of my coworkers cheat on a statistics exam because she didn't know one of the questions. And I was like, yeah, she sent me the prompt and I just pasted it into ChatGPT. And I was like, oh, I sent it back to her. And she's like, oh my God, this actually fits like the multiple choice thing. But like what happens when down the road people just start assuming it's true and there's no way to just like think and question and have a little doubt into these systems?
Yeah, and I think ultimately the responsibility is of the user, right? Like, trust but verify, right? That statement stands across all different things and includes using ChatGPT. Like, if you start to poke at it, and I implore everyone to try it, like, if it gives you an answer, be like, where did you get this answer from? And it'll tell you some, I think the generic answer is like, I'm a language-based learning model, blah, blah, blah. Be like, hey, cite me the source. And it may not be able to give you one. And then you're like, well, show me a place where this information exists. And if you get lucky, you'll get a book or a site. And if not, you won't get anything. And then I encourage you to take what it says and feed it back to it and then see if it'll give you a different answer or, you know, if it'll give you the same thing over and over again or not. So I've caught it a bunch of times. I'm sure other people have too.
All right. And the one last question on your job. Is there like a part type that you guys are most comfortable with? Because I know for me, like I'm looking at different parts that we're making and having to come up with custom work holding. Like, is there like a bread and butter kind of part that you guys do? Like, is it like fits in a certain envelope, a certain shape, turned, machined? Or are you trying to make your process applicable to like really like thin plate work or something? Or like, is the goal for someone to be able to come to your company with literally any machinable part and you guys can figure out a process to make it and automate it?
That is the end goal. So how do we get there? We get there by starting, not small, but starting like one thing at a time. So I think when they originally opened the company, they did aluminum only, and they focused on aluminum parts. And once they started doing it, they took parts that they knew they could do and improve on that. But like, from what I've seen, they do some crazy parts. Like, you can imagine all our customers are like basically all the big space race players, right? They're sending us like thin-walled, tight tolerance, curved surfaces, crazy like outside processing things, and like just like ridiculous true positions across like giant like long, just some gnarly stuff. I've never seen anything like it. So like, I think when they first started, they probably had some specific like part mindset, but I think it's evolved since then, and now we're doing steels, right? So we've added it because we feel confident about our aluminum stuff. Now, as far as fixturing, like the CAM programmer, we design all that fixturing stuff. So like I've only been there, and I've already done things I've never done before as far as like how to hold parts. And the other crazy thing is the part needs to come off the machine fully deburred, edge break. You can't have anything that needs a human process, because then if you leave a burr, guess what? You can't automate a human being sitting there with a deburr tool, right? So it's also been challenging to like, I don't know if you ever tried, but edge breaking everything in the machine is kind of hard sometimes, especially when like you have edges that are going into walls. So
You can get close, right?
So you have to get close enough for your profile tolerance to pass. And our inspection team is like, they make it very hard. Nothing gets through them. They catch everything, right? So like, you have to be on your toes, making sure that your part is very good. So I may not love that while I'm in the thick of it, but I love it in the general sense of like, they're going to make me really good, really fast. And that's ultimately was my original goal, right? Because they do not let anything slide. Like, everything needs to look good. It needs to pass within thing. And they'll catch, if you miss like an edge break or dipper, they'll catch it. Like, there's no way you're not slipping by anything. So
I feel like I can appreciate this more now that, so I guess to sort of segue, I think last year, our machinist at Carbide 3D left for another job, and they thought about hiring someone else or just push it all on me, and they chose that option. So lately I've been like doing setup stuff on all of the machines in Torrents, and like, there's a lot of knowledge that you just like you pick up on the job or you pick up from the guy who came before you. And I super appreciate that you were trying to capture all of that in a digital format. Cause like, I've got this Google cheat sheet for like all the parts that we have, all the things to look out for, but it's not scalable. And like, I'm trying to teach other people to like run the machines and to set up the parts. And like, there's always blind spots. Like, I don't know. Oh, like he doesn't know to check this tool or something. So it's super daunting, but I mean, I'm finally in a position where I can fully appreciate what you're trying to do and all of the challenges that come in that field. But man, you're right. There is a lot of things that we take for granted. Like, I need to remind them, hey, like, make sure there's no chips on the vise. Like, make sure, like, when you put this part in the vise to probe it, that it's in the middle so that the jaws are parallel. There's a lot of little things. It's kind of impressive that you guys can capture most of it. But I mean, I guess if I had to write like a flow diagram and like some decision trees of like, is the stock centered, like I could get there, but it's a problem with a lot of complexity.
It takes a village, right? It's hard to do by yourself. It takes the understanding that our process is not going to be perfect, but that's okay. Like, we're here to make it better each time, right? If we can make one thing better every day, in a year, that's a lot of days of improvement, right? So that's what I love about like Hadrian is the fact that like, hey, we're just here to make things better. If somebody failed or messed up, that's not their fault. That's the process's fault. How do we fix that process immediately, right? So, I mean, just as you said, something as simple as chips on a jaw. How do you clamp a vise? The way you hold the stock when you're clamping. What about when you cut a stock and you're stamping it? Like, how do you do that? Like, a lot of this stuff we do innately without thinking, but like when you try to teach somebody who's never done it before, that's when you start to realize, holy crap, I haven't stopped talking for the last 40 minutes, right? Because there's just so much knowledge to kind of impart and no one can retain that. So how do we do that? We have to create a system where they're looking at a screen, which is what people are used to, and following directions, right? Like, here's a picture, do this, do that. So tackling it one thing at a time, yeah, but it is very hard. But it's the only way that we can solve the problem of like not being able to hire skilled workers, because we just don't have that many growing up to trying to become machinists and things like that, right? So we have to work with what we got. And the way to do that is just to have it all out there. And I'm sure if you spent a year recording your processes and stuff, you would get there too. Like, you would have a really robust standard operating procedure for people to follow.
Yeah, but the downside is that only works like, so right now, I think we have our process down pretty well, but once we switch to a different part or we make a change, like all of that goes out the window and we have to start all over again. So I can't say that I would be disappointed if in a couple years, like when we have a part to prototype, that we just open a browser and send the part to you guys and it comes out at a competitive cost to any other shop. That would be the dream, right? To be able to open up manufacturing and keep it domestic and just, yeah, keep it affordable, keep it domestic, and like have it quickly is the other thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Our goal is like 2 weeks, right? Delivered everything, which is freaking crazy, but yeah.
Dude, 2 weeks is like, sometimes we get like material that takes like 2 or 3 weeks to get here. Like, so you're getting it a finished part to us faster than we can get stuck.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be crazy. I can't wait.
All right. Hey, Eddie, you've been quiet for a little while. What's new with you?
So, I mean, I think the reason we're, it's been a year since we've all done the podcast is we've all had a pretty busy year last year, right? Yeah, big changes for Chris. And it sounds like, Winston, you've been stepping up more on the manufacturing side at Carbide in addition to your...
Busy at work, but also having recently become a homeowner, there's just so many more things that just come crashing down on your schedule.
Well, congratulations on that.
Yeah, congrats.
Thank you.
Yep. So I think of the three of us, I'm the only one that probably hasn't changed roles or companies. I'm still doing my thing here in the garage. Yeah, last year, like basically the last 2 years, just it's been a crazy shop life. I feel now, like the last few months, it's just now kind of reaching a steady state in the shop. You know, I've got consistent processes leading or basically improving my confidence that I'll obtain consistent results in predictable time. Kind of took 2 years to really get to that point where I think a lot of that's just because, you know, I came from outside the manufacturing industry. Like I didn't have the, you know, I basically had to self-teach and all that stuff or self-learn by doing it. So a lot of practical work in the last few years. It's, it feels like it's really starting to pay off now. Yeah, I think my challenge this year is really to keep learning and improving without breaking anything that's already working very well in the shop. So,
I mean, streamlining is pretty important though, right? I'm sure there's like lots of little things you do now, but in the grand scheme of things, like if you'd known about these things like a year or two ago, you'd probably be like, oh, that's not a big deal. But little things can add up to make the overall process just so much less stressful.
Yeah, the challenge with me, you know, since I'm the only one working, like I have to do everything, right? Programming, setting up the machine, keeping an eye on it, and, you know, cleaning up, ordering materials, billing, invoicing, quoting. So, you know, I think my biggest challenge is basically finding efficiencies in every one of those so I had time to do the other parts, right? So, a lot of, you know, I had to really work to get a lot of overlap on work. So the machine's always running. I'm not necessarily having to watch it. I can come in and start programming the next part or respond to a client or something like that, like without having these interruptions where I'm just losing time on one process because I'm dealing with another one, right? So that's kind of what I focused on the last 2 years. And that seems to be working really well now. I can do programming overnight when I'm sleeping, or not programming. I can run like molds overnight when I'm sleeping if I need to. Without any kind of attention needed until basically the job is done. So 2 years ago, you know, I was struggling to kind of keep up with the output that my client needed for the master mold work. And now it's like, that's probably one of the best processes I have going right now because I've done so many of them. And, you know, working with the client, we've really improved the whole overall workflow for that. So everyone's kind of better. They give me better designs, less DFM issues. I can turn them around better for them or faster for them with, you know, less rejects. So that's, you know, it takes, what do they always say? It takes 10,000 hours to become an expert on something. So I can't speak for me, but my Neo's halfway there. It's coming up on the 5,000 hour mark, probably by the end of this month.
Is that 5,000 spindle hours or just
machine hours? Okay. Yeah, I'd probably about half that, probably like 55% on spindle hours. So like 2,500, I think 2,600 total spindle hours on the machine.
Almost sounds like it's time for a second Neo.
Actually, it's so the machine again usually is not my bottleneck. It's me like programming or. Yeah, it's the machine can kind of keep up with me right now. That wasn't the case 2 years ago. Like a lot of time I was waiting on the machine because I was programming in, you know, my code was inefficient. So the programmer longer, or the machining took longer than it needed to. And we were working in more challenging materials. And particularly speaking about the molds, you know, we switched over to from aluminum to plastic, which has trimmed out a ton of time, machining time, you know, with the same end result being just as good as the aluminum. So. That was a big change for us. And then, yeah, like the most of what I did last year was molds and kind of space 2.0, the stuff you were talking about, how everybody's working to catch up with SpaceX, who's lowering the cost to orbit, right? Everyone's trying to figure out where that's, what that means as far as business opportunities. You know, if I can get in my object into orbit for like the price of an Uber ride, like, what can I do with that? So, you know, working with clients that are pursuing opportunities in that space to get stuff up into orbit. So that's been really good. So I do a lot of prototyping work on the Neo now, in addition to, you know, the molds are kind of, I don't call them production, but they're pretty regular when those run. They don't need a lot of like innovation, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word. It's a very predictable work process, but, you know, which would get boring if I didn't have the prototyping work, because that's every new part. It's a, you know, first time I've seen it. It's a challenge to program it, work holding, inspect it, right? So that keeps me fresh, keeps the work interesting. And I'm doing, you know, last year did a lot of that. This year starting to pick up again. It'll be probably very similar to last year, same mix of work. I tell you, last year there was many times when I was kind of wishing I had a 5-axis machine in the garage for some of the stuff I was doing. Came pretty close to pulling the trigger on a purchase around IMTS time last year, which I didn't attend, but I had friends out there sending me info on the machines I was interested in. So it was hard to make that decision because I didn't have quite enough work to justify the price tag. Like, most of the stuff I could get away with doing it on 4-axis on the Neo. Took a little longer, you know, a little more work on the setup and programming. But, and I should mention, like, if I had a 5-axis machine, I wanted one with automation. So that was kind of the whole point. I wanted like a robot tended or pallet tended machine, but it has to fit in my garage. So there's not too many.
Can I ask what machines you were looking at?
Probably the only one that would have been practical here would have been the Kitamura Med Center, which I think I've mentioned before. I still like that machine. And actually, someone I was chatting with on Instagram actually purchased one last year in a similar setup to me. I think he's got a shop space, but he's kind of a solo entrepreneur, runs everything himself. Actually, I can't remember if he got automation. It's automation ready. I think he plans on adding automation. Had it for about 6 months. He seems pretty happy with it.
You're talking about breaking taps?
Yeah, so that was one machine. The main appeal of that one is I think I could run it in the garage. Like, there's enough room for it. It fits. Power requirements would be a bit of a challenge, but the weight of the machines, I could manage that. So if I end up getting it, yeah. But the big thing, like, I'm going to be 60 this year. So I'm kind of like, how much capital investment do I want to make in this business? How much runway do I have to recoup that money before, like, my wife retired from her day job and we're ready to be kind of retired properly. I'm holding off on that, trying to figure out what we want to do. Do we want to go get a bigger space? I know I never want to have employees, so it's going to be automation. It's my only option to scale. Yeah, so I haven't decided yet. So the good news is, like, right now, I'm not missing the 5-axis as much this year. Like, most of my work was probably more suited for the Neo than some of the stuff I had last year. So far. So yeah, it's like, I'm not sweating as much, like, not getting in the queue. Cause like, Chris mentioned, the lead time on machines right now is crazy. I think there were some opportunities at IMTS, you know, to get machines that were on the floor somewhere, but those are probably all gone now.
Oh man. Like, I was walking the floor and like, I came back the next day and there's just like for sold signs everywhere. Like, people are just buying left and right on the spot.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm assuming this is just kind of hangover from COVID, you know, production impacts. Don't really know. Or if it's more economic, like if it's going to kind of turn around pretty fast. If orders start dropping off, if we actually end up in a recession, it might be just the opposite, right? It's easy to get a machine and they're cheap and they're discounted, right? Because nobody's buying. But right now it seems like that's not the case. So the MTBs aren't having any problems finding customers, just getting machines to them in a timely manner.
Out of curiosity, do you think the Pocket NC Solo, I know it probably doesn't have the automation capability, but would those specs fit your needs?
Yeah, as far as the size, every part I had last year where I wish I had the five axis, except for one, would have fit within the work envelope of that machine. Now, I haven't had a chance to actually get hands-on with one to see, you know, if it could actually efficiently do the parts accurately, because these are aerospace parts, but it's definitely, it's a very intriguing machine. It's on my radar. Because I think, you know, even if I didn't need it for the shop, I'm ready for like upgrade my five axis capability here. I still have the Pocket NC V2. It'd be nice to have something like a little more capability and coolant and all that proper and probing, which I think is an option on that machine. It's definitely something I'm watching closely. And I don't know if they're coming to market this year. Yeah, it has an ATC, which is super. Yeah, it checks all my boxes for, and if it's easily on in any place, you know, any spot in my workshop without having to, kick my wife's car out of the garage. I can put it right on the workbench. So.
It's a really exciting time to be like a hobby machinist. Like I really miss having like a five axis desktop machine. There's a couple companies that are coming out with them, but I think there's just even in the three axis space, right? Winston, there's a lot of good options out there. Aren't you guys making some new stuff? I'm not sure how far along you are.
We just put our, we had like the Shapeoko HDM, which was just like a pre-built ships on a pallet. But we're finally at the point now where like we can ship a ball screw machine in a kit form. So like I feel like, and there are other companies that are doing that too, but like now is the time where like where it used to feel like kind of like how 3D printers, like they were like built out of like plywood or something and they slowly started maturing. Like now we're at the state where like you can get a pretty solid three-axis router with all the basic features you want. And go from there. So like the kind of like your baseline experience has improved dramatically in the past 5 years. And now's a pretty good time to be a garage shop.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, it's transitioning from buying an experiment to you're buying a capability when you purchase one of these, like a Shapeoko or Nomad or Bantam.
Oh, I was going to ask, have you had any time to work on things for yourself?
I think I've maybe posted 4 times to Instagram in the last 12 months. So, slacking on the podcast, slacking on Instagram, mostly because the stuff I work on, it's all NDA now, or, you know, it's not stuff I can show. I'm rarely running something on the Neo that I can take a picture of and show up on Instagram. So when I do, I try to post about it. So I think I did the last, like, fun project I did that was not commercial was Christmas. I made some MCD finished Christmas aluminum Christmas ornaments for the family to kind of celebrate a new birth in the family. So I posted a little, I put a post, at least a story up about it. That was kind of fun. So that was a little ISO grid on the back. So I kind of took some of what I learned this last year on doing the aerospace parts and had a little fun with it, with the design.
I think you might have the market for MCD finished Christmas ornaments cornered though. What about you, Chris? Like, have you like been able to make anything? Do you get to throw parts into the queue at work?
Right now, probably not. We've joked about it with some, funny enough, someone started this trend of like RC cars at work. So like there's like 20 of us that bought the same RC car and we're going to do like a series race in our back. We have a huge back like parking lot. And of course, when everyone started looking at the RC parts, we're like, we can make this better. So there's definitely talk of like squeezing in a couple of things here and there. But as you can imagine, like everything is pretty tight as far as schedules. So probably less flexibility with that. So that's why I've been trying to figure out, do I need to dust off my Nomad? Do I need to get something bigger, more robust or whatever? But I've definitely been thinking a lot about garage because I have not really been able to make anything for myself. Especially when I'm so busy, it's hard to like come home from work and the first thing to do is like fire up Fusion and try to like design something when I've been doing that all day, right? When I do get home and I want to spend time with like my wife and my dog and stuff like that. So that's been taking more priority. So I have this itch that is growing significantly daily of trying to make my own stuff. So hopefully soon. I still have ideas. I have this really long Trello list in my personal thing of things I've been thinking about the last like 2 years of what I want to make, how I want to accomplish them. And I'm slowly getting toward like an actual product idea that I want to like launch. So now it's about finalizing, you know, design and stuff like that. And how do I approach this while still working a full-time job? So that's something I have to figure out.
Very cool.
I was going to mention there was a very good interview with Bree Pettis on with Intolerance. I think it was this week or last week.
I'll cue that up.
I'll put a link in the show notes. I think most of our listeners are probably already subscribers to it's one of my favorite podcasts.
I have a question for you two. So we're first quarter of 2023 done. What goals do you guys want to accomplish before the end of this year?
Professionally, I can't say much, but right now my garage is still in a state of disarray. And I really want to get that in shape and like get all my machines moved in by like next quarter. It's just that like with a house that you're already moved into, you've got boxes everywhere, you got shelving, and like the garage isn't what I would call pretty. Like the walls have like this orange peel texture and they're kind of yellowish. And like the floor currently has carpet on it from the previous owner, which is gross. And I like with so much stuff in there, I've got a Tetris stuff around. I was going to originally like epoxy floor it. But then I just, scaled back my ambitions and I'm just like, I'll just do like the PVC tiles and stuff. Right now I'm trying to get around to like scraping or sanding off some of the texture, mudding it over and painting it. But I mean, it's just like a lot of slow, like DIY stuff, but my goal is really just to get back into the swing of like making things in my spare time. Or like if I just want to stay home from work, I can machine stuff at home and like shoot a video or something. So for me, that's my kind of near-term goal. It's just like my shop is in an embarrassing state, and hopefully in the next couple months I can actually like clean it up a little and get it presentable and get back to where I was like a year or two ago before I moved.
Okay. What about you, Ed?
My plan this year was to figure out how to stuff a 5-axis into my existing shop. So yeah, for now I put that on hold. So that was a lot of stress, kind of relieved for the moment. Yeah. So it's really just, basically I think my big challenge is making sure I don't get burned out on what I'm doing. Cause I went into this because I love it. And, you know, the risk is always you do so much of it that you actually end up walking away hating it cause you're so burned out. Right? I'm not at that point right now. I've had some opportunities to take on some production work that I'm still trying to decide, like if that's what I want to do, when the opportunity presents itself. It's good, you know, it's good predictable income, but you're just basically feeding the machine, you know, the same material over and over and over month after month after month. I don't know if that's for me, you know what I'm saying? I think that could potentially lead me down, a path of boredom, and you know, basically you're so busy keeping the machine tended, you're not having time to learn or do new things. So I still feel like what I've been doing, or the work that's been popping up on my radar, it's been perfect for, you know, it's basically new every time. I'm always having to deal with new challenges, which, you know, that's the source of joy for me, is, you know, figuring out a new fixture or something like that. It's that uniqueness and freshness, right? That's kind of keeping this whole thing viable for me, especially with the hours I put in last year. It was crazy. So, but I had a blast. It's like, if I was at my old day job in the beginning, I would have enjoyed that kind of workload. I think, you know, by the end, after 30 years of doing the same thing, it was like all the fun had gone out of it. Right. So I feel like I'm at the early part of, you know, this new manufacturing thing that I do. So, we're still, you know, it's a ton of fun. I can't believe, you know, that you can make a living off this. That's just like icing on the top, right?
And I'll share what my initial goal for the end of this year would be. So my personal goal is I want to be the best programmer that I can be. So then how do I quantify that? Because it's like a super vague thing. So the way that I'm going to quantify it is I want to be able to look at a part. It can have any feature, and I should be able to know how to tackle that feature in less than like 15 seconds. Meaning like I can look at something and be like, oh yeah, I would rough contour and do this, right? And whatever my decision is, like as far as how I approach that feature, should be in the top three best ways to approach that. And that's the only way that I can think of like how to quantify this, because otherwise it ends up being too subjective and I want it to be more objective. So if I grab a part, I look at it, I should be able to know how to tackle everything that's on there, and whatever decision that I'm making for that needs to be within the top three like ways to approach it. Meaning if I ask other people, we should all have the similar answer. Otherwise, it's not the best way to do it, right?
You should see if you could and get your eyes on some medical parts, because that would be a good test. See, I think there's some really challenging features on some of the crazy stuff I've seen. Man, I know aerospace is crazy too, but it's like, I guess because the smallness of the medical stuff, like on top of the crazy tolerances, it's like, I have a lot of respect for people that do that work. I used to think it was something I would be interested in. Now I'm like, no, not at all.
I would love it if I had a Kern. Like, I wouldn't mind it.
Air Swiss, I think Swiss turning seems to be like 80% of that work, but
yeah. So anyways, that's it. And the reason why I asked is because like I'm starting to learn that like if you vocalize stuff that you want to do, and especially if you do it on something like a podcast with two other people, the next time we talk, you'll be more in the back of your head like, huh, I remember the last time we talked about this. Did I achieve this goal? Did I not? And then we can we're on the record. The next time we do talk, hopefully it's not within a year or whatever. I'll bring the goals up again and see how far along we've gotten, and we can kind of, not to shame anybody, but just to kind of help push each other.
I would accept any shaming. I need this motivation because I really hate like the boring little process steps that you just have to get through to get to the end goal.
Yeah, you had a fun project, Winston, that I saw your recent YouTube. I forgot what
one. Oh, yeah. Well, it was done like months ago, but it took me a while to get the video out. But I knocked out a bunch of IsoGrid drink coasters on the Datron. And it was fun to like actually share the process of that, because I feel like a lot of people don't have that experience with like a higher end machine with like the Datron style work holding. And so there's like a lot of challenges you don't think about that at least I can put out there, and at least hopefully people will kind of think about like that style of machining in a different light or have some more insight into it, where it's like, I feel like there's a perception on the internet where it's just like insert part, turn on vacuum, and magical shiny parts come out. But there's a good amount of thought that has to go into how you make that happen in the most optimal way. I'm sure you're familiar, Eddie.
Yeah. I mean, playing to the machine's kind of unique strengths is key to success with Datron equipment. So, yeah, and those are perfect, pretty perfect parts for it. And I think you had did the first batch on the Shape Oco, right? So there's
on the Nomad.
Oh yeah, actually. On the Nomad. So yeah. It's interesting to see the contrast.
So even lower spindle power.
Did you sell these or something, or you just?
Yeah, I sold a couple online. Well, actually, I sold out the batch that I made. But yeah, I've got one saved for you though. Don't worry.
Yeah, they were pretty cool.
No, I swear, I walked around work and I saw one of these on the desk.
It's possible. I know a couple of them shipped like within California.
I'm not even tripping. Like, I just saw this like on Friday. I was walking. I'm like, oh, that's a cool coaster. And I don't know why I didn't see your video pop up either. So that's weird. But yeah. Okay, I'm gonna check on Monday. This is gonna be crazy.
There's another guy who also makes coasters or trivets, and they're a little on the larger side. I think it's a Solid Design Enterprises. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a Neo. He's posting some good stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, he starts with much thicker stock, though. For me, in my opinion, like the coaster has to be thin enough where if you like offset your drink slightly on the edge, it doesn't tip over. But like he does make very beautiful shiny things.
Well, I think that's it for this episode. I No commitment on when we'll do the next episode. We'll play it by ear, but I definitely, it was very enjoyable to get back together. So I do want to wait less than a year before we do the next episode, if possible, if everyone's schedule permits.
We'll make the time.
Really good chatting with everybody, and until next time.
Yeah. Take care, guys.
Take care, guys. Talk soon.